This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know the holiday season has officially started when you start to see the stands of Christmas tree sellers going up in the street, right? Christmas trees are instantly recognizable. Full branches trimmed into that cone-shaped silhouette. You have that woodsy smell. But the trees can come in all shapes, all sizes, and all species, as producer Alexa Lim discovered.
I'm walking down to the pop-up Christmas tree lot in my neighborhood. It's sandwiched in between a little cafe and a bunch of apartment buildings. So we'll see what they have. What's your name?
My name is Guy Dell.
How long have you been selling Christmas trees here?
Over here, 22 years.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow, all right. Do you mind showing me tree? Like, can you show me the Cadillac of trees, like the Escalade of trees?
Okay. This is a Fraser fir. And as you can see, even tied up, how fat it is and how round it is, that would be considered Cadillac. Because when it opens up, it's full and well sculptured. And in order for this to happen, they have to keep clipping the trees. So you wind up with multiple clusters of needles,
right,
that gives it the density. They continue that over the course of the years, which is on average about 15 years for a tree.
So then what are these giant trees here?
What would be a giant Cadillac? It would be the Escalade, okay?
So what's a sedan version?
Economy or family sedan?
Say economy.
Economy would be this variety. Trees are graded pretty much like any produce in the market. Meat, vegetables, right? So this is a lower grade tree. And this line, which is the balsam fir, that come from Canada. When they open up, as you could see, space in between, they're not perfect all the way around. They're not dense. They're not well sculptured. They're not well balanced.
Right.
But they are great trees.
What's that little guy right there?
Oh, that's a Charlie Brown style.
You're holding that up with one hand right now.
Oh, with two fingers.
That's right. All right. I'll take this little tree.
Of course.
All right. Thank you.
Keep your tree and have a Merry Christmas.
Yeah. Merry Christmas to you too.
Producer Alexa Lim chatting with the Christmas tree guy, you know, and after you've decorated your tree and you've opened the gifts around it, you've probably experienced another sign of the holidays, the trail of dried green needles that your tree left behind. Well, how to prevent the dreaded needle drop? Science is coming to the rescue, and for my next guest, Christmas happens all year round. He runs a Christmas tree lab. Yes, there is a science of the Christmas tree. Gary Chesthagner is a professor of plant pathology at Washington State University in Puyallup, Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
I didn't realize that there are guys who just, you know, are interested in Christmas trees like you.
Yes, there's a few of us, not a lot. They tend to be located in the major Christmas tree production areas.
Well, let's talk about the kinds of trees. Alexa was walking through the trees there. What kinds of species of trees are there?
There's many different types of conifers that are grown as Christmas trees, and some of it's regional, but if you look nationally at what the most common species are, they would be Fraser fir, balsam fir, Douglas fir, noble fir.
What kind of lab do you need to study Christmas trees? Does it smell like Christmas all year round in your lab?
No, unfortunately, not all year long. We have two very large temperature-controlled post-harvest rooms, and so when we're doing post-harvest trials at this time of year, when we have trees set up and displayed, then it does smell like Christmas. But other times I'm also working on disease problems on Christmas trees, and so it's a sort of a traditional mycology lab where we have microscopes, autoclaves, and things like this, and we're growing pathogens that attack Christmas trees on artificial media in a research type environment.
Tell us more about that. I don't think we've talked very much about stuff that attacks the tree. What are we talking about here? And does it like spread through a whole grove of trees if you don't take care of it?
Certainly some of the diseases can. Some of the foliar diseases that get on the needles have airborne spores, and so the growers have to be constantly monitoring their fields for these diseases, and doing a variety of cultural practices, and in some cases using a fungicide to protect their trees. In other situations, there's diseases that are in the soil. They reside in the soil. The pathogens reside in the soil, and they may be associated with wet soils like Phytophthora root rot that can kill trees.
Let's talk about the needle dropping I mentioned at the beginning. All right. What causes it? How do you prevent it in your tree?
The biggest factor that causes it is the genetics of the tree. Some tree species are predisposed to shed needles, much more so than others. But really, it's the tree drying, and as the tree dries, it tends to shed needles as a protective measure, you know, so that under natural conditions, it wouldn't continue to dry to a point where the tree would be damaged. So it's sort of a defense mechanism that trees have, and if we cut trees and display them indoors, and if they're not properly cared for, i.e. displayed in water, then as they begin to dry, some of them will start shedding needles to various degrees.
Mm-hmm. How can you tell? Can you tell from the needles themselves the health of a tree?
Generally, you could tell how fresh the tree is. Let's say if a consumer's going to a retail lot, you can tell, maybe get some idea on how fresh the tree is by, does it have good color? Do the needles appear nice and green, relatively soft? They're not falling off. You shouldn't see any needle loss of the tree, particularly green needles. Sometimes older dead needles that are on the inside of the tree may be coming off, but that's not an indication of how fresh the tree is.
Is there a test you can perform yourself on it? You know, look at the branches, bend it, do something?
It's really hard to tell. There are certain species that you can actually take the needles off of a tree and sort of try to bend them between your fingers, much like a carrot stick. And if the needles are off of a tree that has a really high moisture content, they'll snap just like a carrot stick. And as they dry out, then they become more rubbery and they bend a lot more.
Just like a carrot.
So sort of like a carrot, in how fresh a carrot stick might be.
Mm-hmm. We covered a really interesting story a few years ago that said that never put a fruit basket beneath the tree because the ethylene will cause the needles to drop, like a banana ripening. What do you think of that idea?
Well, there's a lot of research, particularly going on in Nova Scotia with balsam fir, that indicates that ethylene may be a contributing factor in needle loss. We currently have a project underway to look at the role of ethylene in needle loss in a broader range of species. And we sort of have a mixed result at this point in time. It's not clear. These studies have just started. So I think it's a little early to tell that. But we see needle loss on trees that are stored outdoors where there's lots of air movement, and you wouldn't expect ethylene to be the contributing factor there. So there may be more than one thing that's going on that's associated with needle loss.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that you visit Christmas trees a lot on your vacation, sort of a busman's holiday that you take to Christmas tree lots.
Yes, at this time of year when I'm on vacation, like at Thanksgiving, visiting my son and his family in Tucson, I usually take a few days to go visit the Christmas tree lots. And I have in my research also specifically traveled and visited large numbers of Christmas tree lots to try and get some understanding on what the quality of trees is to consumers, and how much more importantly, how much breakdown there is in loss of quality between where the trees are shipped out of a production region such as the Pacific Northwest to various markets throughout the U.S. A lot of growers, you load the trees, they may be really good quality, fresh trees. you don't see them at the end. You don't know whether the problems in during transit, how they're being handled on the retail lots, et cetera. So we've done a lot of sampling of trees on retail lots over the years.
How long does it take to grow a Christmas? How old is that tree I'm buying on the street there?
It varies a little depending on the species and the region. The Pacific Northwest, for example, typically you're talking about probably 7, 8, 9 years. In some other areas, it may take 10 to 15 years because they don't have as favorable growing conditions, or they're growing species that tend to grow slower.
So they've had to take good care of that tree for 10 to 15 years.
That's right. Sometimes consumers may, you know, they may not fully understand that Christmas trees are an agriculture crop. They're not being harvested out of the forest. They're planted in plantations, and the growers plant them as seedlings that are usually 2 years, maybe 3 years old at the time of planting. And then that grower has to protect that tree from diseases and insects, take care of that tree, culture the tree as far as shearing it or pruning the branches to increase density for a period of, 10 years or so. So there's a lot of effort into producing the quality of trees that are on the market today.
And what's the biggest thing you would like to know as a tree scientist about growing Christmas trees?
Well, we're doing some work to understand the genetics of needle loss and how we can identify trees and sources of trees that do not genetically shed needles. So in other words, even if they dry, they're not going to shed needles. So being able to develop genetic markers that would allow us to test an individual tree and tell genetically whether or not it's a source that has good needle retention or poor needle retention would be extremely helpful for the Christmas tree industry and consumers to ensure that they're getting trees that have minimal risk of needle shedding.
Well, Merry Christmas to you, and hope you find a nice Christmas tree lot on your trip this back home perhaps this year.
Okay, thank you very much.
Gary Chesthagner is professor of plant pathology at Washington State University. We're going to take a break and come back and talk about prescription pills contributing to at least half of the deaths in the current opioid epidemic. New figures out this hour from the Centers for Disease Control. We'll talk about them. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. The deaths from drug overdose is staggering, and in new data just released this afternoon for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Atlanta point that out. It says, in 2015, more than 52,000 people died from a drug overdose, and of those, 33,000 involved a prescription or illicit opioid. And since 2000, more than 300,000 Americans have lost their lives to an opioid overdose. And maybe you know people who have suffered from that yourself. In the current opioid epidemic, Kentucky, West Virginia, and Ohio have been hit hard. Opioids include both heroin and prescription pain pills, and at least half of fatal opioid overdoses involve prescribed pain meds. We talked to Emily Walden from Louisville, Kentucky, who lost her son TJ to a prescription pain pill overdose.
My son was 21 years old. He was offered an OxyContin at a party around the age of 17, close to 18. And I don't know how many times he did that drug, oral Panna, within a time period, but he became addicted very, very quickly. And Opana was all over Louisville, so that drug was very easy to obtain. When he told me that he was using Opana, I didn't know what it was. I had no idea. So I started doing some research. You know, I put him in treatment. He was clean for periods of time. And then he would use again. And then he would be clean again. He was in the National Guard, the Kentucky National Guard. He had been away to some training through the Guard. And when he got back, like a week later, he went on a camping trip with some friends. And my guess was, we'll use one more time. And he lost his life on that trip. He was not prescribed it. He said, I don't want to die from this. I want to get better. I want to live a normal life. I don't want to be like this. TJ was a very good kid. He had no idea that what he was taking was equal to heroin, and neither did I.
Emily Walden from Louisville, Kentucky. Will stemming the flow of prescription pills be the key to ending this epidemic? How are synthetic opioids complicating the situation, and what can be done? My next guests are here to discuss the growing epidemic. Andrew Kolodny is co-director of the Opioid Policy Research Collaborative at Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Michael Kilkenny is the physician director at Cabell Huntington Health Department in Huntington, West Virginia. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Michael, Huntington has been particularly hard hit. One day in August, there were 26 overdoses in just 6 hours, I understand. Is Ms. Walden's experience similar to ones that you've heard from other parents?
Well, yes, we've certainly heard that experience having to do with prescription opioids, and we've had some deaths associated with that here, but we have a little bit of a different situation here with more heroin and heroin-related compounds causing death in our community at this point.
Michael, how does the path get to the heroin point? Does it start with prescription drugs?
Our perception here is that an unintended consequence of responsible prescribing efforts that perhaps were done improperly that started in about 2011 in this region essentially drove people who were taking prescription drugs, albeit improperly, to heroin.
Andrew Kolodny, what do you think?
So we have a severe opioid addiction epidemic that's affecting two age groups. There's a younger group that's affected and an older group that's affected. The younger group is developing its opioid addiction mostly through non-medical use or recreational use of pain medicines, sometimes through a medical exposure. That younger group, when they get addicted, they have a hard time finding doctors who will maintain them on a large quantity of pills. Doctors don't like giving healthy-looking 25-year-olds lots of pain medicines, unless maybe that doctor's a drug dealer. And so that younger group winds up on the black market. The pills are very expensive on the black market. If they're in a region of the country where heroin is available, they switch because it's cheaper. And what's happened over the past 20 years is heroin has become more available in more places where it wasn't previously available to meet the demand for it by this growing number of young people. What's happened since 2011 is that the heroin supply has become increasingly dangerous. The heroin supply now has another drug mixed into it, a completely synthetic opioid called fentanyl, which is far more potent. It makes the heroin much more dangerous. And since 2011, we've seen a sharp increase in overdose deaths among heroin users, not because people have suddenly switched to heroin, but because the heroin supply became much more dangerous. It's important to understand that we do have an older group of people that are also opioid addicted. These are people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. That older group, when they become addicted, that group does not have a hard time finding doctors who will maintain them on a large quantity of pills on a monthly basis. And we really haven't been seeing that older group switch to heroin. There's a notion that there was a crackdown on painkillers and that led people to switch from pills to heroin. That's not really true. We are still massively overprescribing opioids.
Mm-hmm. Michael Kilkenny, Huntington worked at tackling the prescription pain med problems by trying to shut down the pill mills, those places where meds are being dispensed improperly. But there were consequences that I understand that you didn't foresee.
Yeah, I think that what Dr. Kolodny said is received as correct, and we can't necessarily dispute it, but our perception is that our switch away from prescription opioids that we definitely were over-prescribing was not met with the response that we thought it would be, and that is people stopping using opioids instead. Well, I think we underestimated their dependence on the drug, and they did switch to heroin.
Now, I understand that
our experience, I think, is different from the New York City experience and their experience on Staten Island that's been publicized and well-studied, and they've done a fantastic job with prescription opioids in New York City. The Appalachian experience, our demographic is different, and I think that we're possibly dealing with a different epidemic here.
I understand there are now HIV cases springing up from this epidemic, Dr. Kilkenny?
There are. In southern Indiana, in a small rural community, the HIV cases went from less than 10 in a year to over 200 in 1 year. And that was due to intravenous drug use. There are a great many other counties that are at risk of a similar outbreak, and we are one of those counties. The cities are doing a much better job. They have a lot longer experience in dealing with HIV and intravenous drug use, and they've done a fantastic job of controlling it. But in our environment, we're trying to prevent that.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to the phones. If you'd like to call in and talk to us, 844-724-8255. Let's go to Scott in Mount Vernon, Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Well, hello.
Hey there. Go ahead.
Well, I guess the issue that I have, and I've worked as a drug treatment counselor, and I've worked with youth most of my life, and a lot of times there's been drug issues with that. And the problem that I'm seeing is this whole term opioid epidemic. It's really kind of putting a whole, you know, millions of people who have a terrible pain, and as the population ages, what we have is a pain epidemic more than an opioid epidemic. We have a pain epidemic and we have a heroin epidemic. And lumping them together is really making a lot of people feel like criminals. And there's a lot of times when they do develop a dependence on opioids, painkillers, Vicodin, that sort of thing, OxyContin, they get into a drug treatment program that treats them the same way that they would treat someone that's addicted to heroin. Mm-hmm. It's just not going to work.
Let me get a comment. Thanks for your call. Dr. Kolodny, what do you
think? Yeah, to be clear, we have an epidemic of opioid addiction, not really an epidemic of abuse. The problem isn't that there are a bunch of people out there taking dangerous drugs because it feels good and they're accidentally killing themselves. The problem is that we've had this sharp increase in the number of people with addiction. And some people have become addicted because they were taking pills recreationally, but many people have also become addicted taking pills as prescribed by a doctor. And it's this large increase in the number of people who are addicted that's leading to this crisis. We do have many people who suffer from chronic pain. Chronic pain is common, and it's becoming more common as our population ages. But opioids are lousy drugs for chronic pain. Opioids are good medicines for end-of-life care. They also play an important role when used for a couple of days after major surgery. But when they're prescribed to patients who have chronic non-cancer pain, when they're taken every day for weeks and months and years, they're more likely to harm the patient than help the patient. And we have maybe 10 to 12 million Americans who are on opioids chronically. So many Americans on opioids chronically that we see ads during the Super Bowl for medicines like an opioid-induced constipation drug to treat the side effects of being on opioids. They're being massively overprescribed.
It sounds like you're saying the same thing that happened with antibiotics prescription is happening with opioids.
Yeah, that's correct. There are a lot of parallels there. Patients will come into a doctor and want an antibiotic when they have a cold virus,
right.
And the easy thing for the doctor to do is give that patient an antibiotic rather than counsel them about the difference between an antibiotic, between a virus and a bacteria. And the easy thing for many prescribers is to just keep writing the opioid prescription. So there are parallels there.
So they don't offer them any alternative to opioids?
Well, primary care doctors may have 10, 15 minutes to spend with a patient. And if the patient comes in and wants that prescription, it's the easiest thing to do. It's a little harder sometimes to figure out where there's a physical therapist in that patient's insurance network or to recommend alternative treatments.
Michael Kilkenny, do you agree with that prognosis?
I agree with almost everything that Dr. Kolodny just said, and certainly it is easier for the primary care physician to prescribe in that 15-minute encounter than it is to counsel and address issues. And a lot of primary care physicians don't have the tools or the skills to counsel and address opioid addiction during their visit, or substance use disorder is probably a better term to use.
Mm-hmm. We hear reports, people saying, you know, the opioids produced in places like China and Mexico, these are the real sources. We should stop the sources of them coming into the country, Dr. Kolodny. What's your take on that?
That's not really the problem. The problem is that we have an epidemic of addiction. So many people have become addicted. And so heroin and heroin with fentanyl in it and is flooding into these areas to meet the demand for it. If we want to bring the opioid addiction epidemic to an end, what we have to do is prevent new people from getting addicted. And that mostly boils down to more cautious prescribing so that we don't directly addict patients and so that we don't stock homes with a highly addictive drug. And then for the millions that are addicted, we have to see that they have access to effective addiction treatment. If, for example, you just close down pill mills like in West Virginia without seeing that the customers of those pill mills have access to addiction treatment, then they're going to turn to mm-hmm. heroin or heroin with fentanyl in it. So we have to see that there's mm-hmm. effective treatment out there for people.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about the epidemic of opioid addiction. Michael, what about programs in terms of harm reduction?
Well, when we get into the situation where the epidemic really is heroin, like it is here, then we're dealing with a population of injection drug users, and those people sustain risks from infection, either bacterial infection due to contaminated contents of the injection, or due to viruses from the sharing of needles. Viruses in one person's bloodstream can spread to another person's bloodstream through the sharing of needles and syringes. So harm reduction focuses on access to clean syringes and then takes that kind of carrot of a clean syringe and introduces other harm reduction tools, education about proper injection, access to recovery coaches, and entry into treatment where it's available, and it goes on from there. We do immunizations against hepatitis B if they don't already have that, and we act as an entry point into a more comprehensive mm-hmm. health service.
Mm-hmm. One last question. The 21st Century CARES Act that is making its way to President Obama's desk includes funds for states for treatment and prevention. How would you like to see that used?
Well, it does look like the money is earmarked to help states expand access to effective addiction treatment, particularly a treatment with a medicine called buprenorphine or Suboxone. And I think that is the right approach. We need treatment to be easier to access than pills or heroin if we're going to get anywhere in this crisis. I think this $1 billion over 2 years is a start, we're going to need a much bigger federal investment in this problem if we want to tackle it properly.
We've run out of time. I want to thank both of you, Dr. Michael Kilkenny, Physician Director at Cabell Huntington Health Department in Huntington, West Virginia, Andrew Kolodny, Director of the Opioid Policy Research Collaborative at Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, switching gears, we're going to get on your hiking boots, but you really don't have to leave your desk. We're going on a geological field trip, and it's got some 3D and VR. It's just terrific stuff. It's on our website. We'll talk about how you can go on this trip without getting wet or cold. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The Earth has stories to tell about its formation if you know how to read the rocks. But sometimes it can be hard for the average person to get to a good place to see the geologic evidence. But now there is help. Ryan Hollister, a high school science geoscience teacher in Turlock, California, and an educator in this year's Science Friday Educator Collaborative, has built a virtual field trip. This is an interactive 360-degree experience complete with 3D graphics of individual rocks. You can literally pick up a rock and spin it around and see all the sides. And the landscape chosen for our virtual field trip is a site called the Columns of the Giants in the Sierra Nevadas. It's up on our website at sciencefriday.com/photosphere. Go try it out. And Ryan's here to talk about it with me now. He joins us via Skype. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
This is an amazing project. I was just blown away by this. Tell our listeners, walk us through how you made this resource.
All right. Well, it was pretty easy. The first step was having to go out and take about 150 pictures of rocks that I wanted to include in this virtual photosphere, which is up in the Sierra Nevadas. And then I had to come home and spend hours and hours and hours trying to learn how to stitch photos together and make these three-dimensional photospheres, and then try to figure out what was the best way I could possibly engage students once these photospheres were made. Some of the photospheres, you can kind of think of it like a Google Street View on steroids with just super-duper high resolution, so you can zoom in and zoom out and allow students to see things. So my question really was, how can I get my students engaged to find and solve some of the geologic mysteries of how this landscape formed? But it involved about 7 miles of hiking and bushwhacking and getting up to the top and setting up my tripod, and a lot of patience back home in the post-production stage.
I can imagine, because one of my favorite parts of the tour is that you can actually, there are rocks lying around that you can pick up virtually and spin them around. They're 3D models of individual rocks and elements. How hard was it to make that?
Pretty tricky. There's a few folks, Callum Bentley, who teaches at Northern Virginia Community College. He kind of pioneered, he's the one I saw it from, but you basically have to take about 150 images of each individual rock. So it's an actual rock that came from the field, and I put it on turntables and had to practice with the lighting. And once all those pictures are made and you get every single angle that you possibly can of that rock, then it takes about 2 hours or 2 days of photo stitching in the software to make it come together and apply the texture and stuff, which it was interesting. It wasn't hard. It just time consuming.
Yeah. Tell us about the site that you chose. Why this site in particular, and what will it help students learn there?
Well, so this site is actually got some really amazing places. It's up in Sonora Pass in the Sierra Nevadas. And most people know the Sierras as these big, huge, you know, amazing granitic mountains. And there just happens to be a spot where this basaltic lava flow kind of filled up a granitic valley. So the big question is, how did this basaltic flow get there? And then it makes these really amazing weird shapes, these gigantic hexagonal columns that are maybe 200, 300 feet high that break off in these just gigantic hexagonal chunks. How did it get there and why are they there? And then as the students hike up to the top of the Columns of the Giants, there's these funny big granitic boulders sitting on top of these basaltic lava flows that are very out of place. And so they're going to try to solve those mysteries of how that happened. But it's just really unique. There's just not many volcanic features like that there. And the main goal was to try to relate this to a story on Iceland that was on Science Friday a few years ago. And at the end of this whole trip, once people are able to kind of decipher the story of what happened here, they'll be able to apply that, their knowledge, to try to figure out how places in Iceland were formed and even on Mars, which is pretty slick.
So you're basically giving us a tour of an old volcano site.
Yeah, there's definitely a lava flow on the top. It's still kind of up for debate of where it came from. There's some sites around there, and I discuss it briefly, but it's, yeah, better geologists than me will know for certain in a few years exactly where it came from.
Did you know what you're going to, we were going to do, or where we were going in this project, or did you learn along the way?
I had to learn along the way. When I applied for the Educator Collaborative, I kind of shot my mouth off and thought, well, wouldn't it be great if we could incorporate some of the latest and greatest technology? And
yeah, that really helps around here. We're convinced by that kind of talk.
But yeah, I had no idea really of what to do, and then they accepted me. So it was a very sharp learning curve over the summer to research and design and come up with the right off-the-shelf software that I could use to make it what I wanted. Mm-hmm. So it was a big learning process, right, for sure.
Now, tell us what's the best way to approach this. When you go onto the site, what should we do and how should we take the tour?
Well, the first thing, you actually drop into what I call a blank photosphere. So there's six stops within this field trip. And basically, you can jump into the first photosphere with kind of no prodding and just cruise around and zoom in and zoom out and find things that you look interesting. For students, we're going to be having them make field sketches, so you get a little bit more observational details that they may have otherwise missed. And you can kind of cruise around that, and then after you pop out of the blank photosphere, there's a bunch of information that'll tell you how to tell apart different types of rocks like granite and basalt. That's a huge differentiation people need to know to tell a big story. And then there's like evidence for glaciation. How do we know glaciers were here? How might you know? Some other things like that. There's also some lichenometry that I included, where lichen falls on these talus piles, these broken piles of rock at the bottom, and scientists can actually infer the age of rock falls based on how much lichen has grown on them, which is pretty slick. So after they have all that information, then they can go into an annotated photosphere, which kind of, as a geology teacher, gives people the knowledge they would need to know to solve this without actually giving them the answers. They'll have to consult some field guidebooks and things like that, but it'll kind of help them piece together and hopefully at the end come up with a solution of how this landscape formed. So it doesn't explicitly give them the answers. It's trying to be a discovery.
Well, you know, I'm not a geology student. I'm not in school anymore, but I really love taking this tour myself. I mean, anybody can take this. It's not just for students. And as you go along the way, you find different rocks and different things, and you pick them up, and you examine them. It's like a video game. Yeah.
It kind of is, and my students were finally able to see the live view today right before they took their final. So they are pretty excited about seeing it and getting to run through it next year. And I think what separates mine from other photospheres that are out there is just the resolution is super high. And at AGU last week, I heard somebody mentioned that pixels are data. So to be able to have such high resolution and be able to have this extra data, it's just really a lot nicer than zooming into a blur of pixelated images, which I think it's got a lot of potential, especially for disabled geology students that maybe will never have a chance to get out in the field to these places. I think it'll allow them to experience it firsthand in a much higher quality way.
Well, I hope to see more of this in other places because you've created a terrific technique here.
And, well, thank you so much.
And I can't wait to go back and jump in. And anybody can jump in. The tour is on our website at sciencefriday.com/photosphere, put together by Ryan Hollister, just like in California, the geosciences teacher at Turlock High School, California, part of the SciFry Educator Collaborative. Ryan Hollister, happy holiday to you, and thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much. You too.
It's not easy to get to Mars, especially on your first try. Every country, every space agency has failed on its first attempt, except one. Can you guess what that? Well, which country was that? India. 2 years ago, India became the first country to make it all the way to the Red Planet on its first try. And that nail-biting mission is the latest in our Science Friday video series, Breakthroughs, Portraits of Women in Science. Science documentarian Emily Driscoll produced that video, and she's here in our New York studio. Welcome back, Emily.
Hi, Ira.
So let's talk about the focus of this series.
Sure. So Breakthrough, as you said, it's a series of six films, and they're portraits of women in science across STEM fields. And they show the challenges, but also the excitements of what it's like to work in science. And these challenges include things like having a disability, to working in really tough conditions in the Arctic, to this film, which is about what it's like to work on India's first interplanetary mission.
So you went to where in India did you go?
Went to Bangalore. Went to three centers of the Indian Space Research Organization in Bangalore. Yeah, and we went there because when the satellite, which is the Mars Orbiter mission, or it's called MOM, when it successfully entered into orbit around Mars, there was a photo of the control room, and it was all these women in colorful saris celebrating, hugging each other, very jubilant. And that photo went viral. So we wanted to investigate. We wanted to know who are some of these women, what are their roles, and what is it like to work on such a historic mission.
Mm-hmm. I think when one of the, I remember the mission when it was successful, and one of the most interesting parts of the mission was how cheaply they did it. Right?
Yes.
Give us an idea of how cheaply that.
MOM cost $74 million. And just to compare, NASA's MAVEN mission, which launched around the same time and entered Mars orbit around the same time, that cost $671 million. And the film Gravity even cost more than MOM at $100 million.
Wow. And despite that tight budget, the stakes were pretty high, weren't they?
They were. As you mentioned, no country has successfully reached Mars on its first attempt. No Asian nation has reached Mars successfully. And they had 18 months to do this at the Indian Space Agency, and none of them had ever worked on an interplanetary mission before. So the stakes were very high, and the Mars orbit insertion was a very critical maneuver. And we followed Nandini Harinath and Sita Somasundaram and Meenal Rohit in the film, and they're physicists and engineers, and they talk a little bit about it in the film, why it was such a critical maneuver and what it was like in the control room during that time.
If we had had slightly less velocity, we would have crashed onto Mars. If we had had more velocity, we would have just gone off as a flyby.
It's like hitting a bullseye on a dartboard, standing some few 10,000 kilometers away.
For 2 to 3 minutes, we just were holding our breath. Communication was established, and we saw the telemetry, and that it was in orbit. That was probably the sweetest words we heard on that day.
And we are now achieved 1,098.7 meters.
All protocol was broken. Everybody got up from the console.
So it was excellent moment. I people will never forget that moment.
Then Madam Sita asked, where is the data?
Yeah, where is the data?
Yeah, so it was primarily a technology demonstrator to see, can they actually make it to Mars and orbit around Mars? So the launching, the Mars orbit insertion, the autonomy. But they did have small payloads, like a methane sensor, Mars color camera, so a lot of the data is from that. And Meenal Rohit in the film worked on both of those payloads. So you'll see the first full disk image of Mars because their highly elliptical orbit took them 80,000 kilometers away. So they could get a shot of the whole disk without having it be a mosaic of thousands of different images and different close-ups of the planet. But they do, now that they've done this, they plan for further missions with expanded scientific payloads.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Emily Driscoll and her new Breakthrough Series video about the scientists in India who were doing the MOM mission. I mean, when you hear that applause. It's almost like the Super Bowl going on there, and that's how they looked at it, right?
Absolutely. The Prime Minister was right there with them in the tracking center. People all around India, school children, were watching it live. So it was high stakes. It was such an exciting moment.
Mm-hmm. I understand peripherally that the Indian Space Research Organization, ISRO, has award-winning gardens, and they take famous tea breaks.
Yes. So I visited there, and Bangalore is actually the garden city. Mm-hmm. And once you get past the multiple high-security gates, they have a lovely garden, and they recycle wastewater. And in other centers, they have volunteers plant trees to get more wildlife there. And they have tea breaks, which is mid-morning, mid-afternoon, and they work very long hours, very hard. And even if they work 20 hours a day, they'll stop for tea breaks again in the middle of the night or in the morning. So it's a great way to just get away a little bit from work and refresh and come back.
Very civilized.
Yeah.
So what's next on the agenda for Israel?
So they have a follow-up mission, MOM-2, and right now they're seeking and reviewing different science proposals, and that'll have heavier payloads, so chances for more expanded scientific missions. And then early in next year, they're going to launch a record 83 satellites at once, and 80 of them are going to be foreign satellites.
You mean from other people wanting to put satellites up? So India is really becoming a power,
yes,
a space-faring power.
Yes. Absolutely.
And have they talked about going, putting people on Mars someday? Or they
possibly.
Just, right now they just want to get to Mars and proof concept.
Right now they're working with NASA and different companies in different countries. So we'll see. And they have more plans for Venus and the moon as well as Mars.
Now I understand that they love space travel so much that their currency now carries pictures.
Yes. Mm. So their highest paper currency now has MOM on it. And, you know, this was really a source of pride and inspiration for the country, and it gave them confidence for these future missions. And so I think having it on the highest paper currency is a great place for MOM.
Who could say it any better? It's a great place for all kinds of MOM. Thank you, Emily. Emily Driscoll, science documentary producer based here in New York. You can see her great video. It's up on our website, the whole series there of breakthrough videos, sciencefriday.com/breakthrough, if you're looking for some interesting viewing tonight and all during the holiday week next week. That's about all the time we have for this week. BJ Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. If you'd like to write us, you can still write us the classic way. The mail still gets here. Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. You can email us, scifry@sciencefriday.com. And, you know, we're on Facebook. Like us on Facebook if you like it, and we're there all week. And also, we're tweeting @SciFry. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.